Well, it's certainly a pleasure having you here, despite this rocky start. Uh-huh. Last time I saw you, you would remember me, of course, because I was one of many hundreds and hundreds of people, but it was at the Penn International Congress, which was held here in Manhattan. And I remember you vividly stalking up to the microphone during every lull.
Not me alone, it was also Salman Rushdie, if you remember, before he became famous by this terrible fatwa.
That's right. I taped everything. So I still have you on tape, and Vargas Llosa, and Rushdie, and it was a wonderful thing that I hadn't seen anything quite like that that Congress, either before or after, not in New York.
Yes, it was in the dark Reagan time in America.
It was.
And the opposition was coming by European authors. I didn't like the way how, speaking about perhaps of Vargas Llosa, he said there are only writers in the Soviet Union or East Germany or Czechoslovakia who are following the court or dissidents. And I said there's a group of writers who believe they are communists, but they are also in opposition to the government. That was much, much nearer to the reality. And he did ignore this was one of the struggles.
Right. And The Call of the Toad, effectively, is a novel, essentially, that takes place after the fall of communism, or during the process of its dismemberment. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that this book reflects that change. I was reading another book completely different from yours. It was written by Martin Cruz Smith called Red Square. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that book, it takes place in Munich, mm-hmm. in Berlin, and in Moscow. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about it, while it's a thriller mm-hmm. Dealing with a Soviet homicide inspector, mm-hmm. it reflects the changes, the everyday changes mm-hmm. in the former Soviet Union mm-hmm. and the rise of the black marketeers mm-hmm. and how the black marketers, mm-hmm. who are called mafiosis, mm-hmm. In fact, have a large community in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting how it has changed the fabric of life. For example, in order to buy a bottle of vodka, mm-hmm. you must return an empty bottle, mm-hmm. And you stand in line. Mm-hmm. You stand in line 2 hours for Beats. Mm-hmm. So, in a way, it's a mixed blessing, isn't it? The fall of communism, the collapse of the wall, a mixed blessing because it has brought both positive things in that there is a great deal of freedom, but it's brought a certain degree of economic disaster, too.
I think the Western world was very much surprised by the collapse of communism. And now they are without the picture of an enemy. And they have to recognize also in West Germany that they don't have an idea. They have money, perhaps. But that's not enough. This kind of collapse in the Eastern world is just in the beginning. The beginning was in the late 80s, and it's going on and going on. Now we have this disaster situation in Yugoslavia. Nobody takes care for this. That's 12 years after the death of Tito, and it was possible to think about it, what will happen there. But nobody did. All this foreign office of the Western world, they were asleep, I think. There was no, when the change started 2 years ago with Croatia and Slovenia, the Western world was without any idea how to react, and it's still up to now. And the Polish situation, this is my book now, you have a changed situation between Germany and Poland now. Before, East Germany, belonging to the Eastern Bloc, was between West Germany and Poland. And now the frontier of the hard currency of D-Mark is from the Elbe River to the Oder River, just to the Polish border. And this does bring to Polish people, on one side, they admire the economic system of the Western world, but on the other side, they have to live without a rich brother, like the East Germans have. They have to do it by themselves, and they are afraid that the strong economic system of Germany, of West Germany, of Germany, now the Greater Germany, can change situation in Poland. Can perhaps the western provinces of Poland, who were before belonging to Germany, will be occupied not by armies but by economic strength. And this is one background of my book.
It's also very much a novel about reconciliation.
Yeah.
Because the Alexander and Alexandra in the book are obsessed by the idea of forming a cemetery, which is a cemetery of reconciliation.
Yeah. This couple is both about 60 and widows. They have this in the beginning this human idea that the refugees can come back when they are dead, find their last place in their homeland. And but this idea, when it is realized, becomes more and more business-like. Mm. It occupies more and more, and the Germans, she said, the Germans are always hungry, also if they are fed up. And I tried to show this this idea and the collapse of the idea and the comic of the collapse.
Where capitalism, in a way, intrudes against the ideals that the two originally set out.
Yeah.
But the extent that capitalism is an evil is a question, though, isn't it? Because isn't it true that the communist world, in effect, collapsed because of a failed economic system?
Sure, sure. This is one, but the Western capitalistic system cannot work immediately in the system where there is no market. This is one side, and I think this long struggle, this war, this Cold War between the both systems, it is too easy to say that they have lost and we are the winners in the West. Also, the Western side is blessed. Also, the economic system, as we see now, is blessed by this long Cold War. Too many intelligence was going to military subjects. And you see it in the United States, you see it also in the Western part of Europe, that this kind of business with weapons doesn't work anymore as it did before. And you see the weakness also of the Western system. Sometimes I have the feeling that the Western side is not very happy with the situation to be the winner without the enemy picture. They lost it, and now they are looking for a new enemy.
Oh, yeah. It's tough to find an enemy today. It's very difficult. It's difficult to write books.
But do we need enemies? This is a question. This is a question. And this, in my book, this couple say, and the cemetery, all this has to finish. Dead people are no more enemies, and we have to start with this new neighborhood of Germans and Polish people after all these blessings first done by the Germans to the Polish people. And then, at the end of the war, they kicked out 9 million German peoples. It was another blessing. And now we have to finish this. This is the idea in the beginning of the book. And then it turns more and more to a business idea. And it is, on one side, very successful by business, but on the other side, it is not successful. It doesn't work.
During the United States presidential campaign, the incumbent George Bush took full credit for the collapse of the communist world, fall of the wall. What conceit that a single man or administration would bring about a change of structure in a huge area such as Europe and Asia. That doesn't make sense, does it?
No.
One person could take
think,
credit for that.
I think that we have to go back to history. When, just after the October Revolution, with Lenin, was successful, the first critic did come from European socialists. First Rosa Luxemburg and Kautsky in Germany. Rosa Luxemburg from a Polish prison, she wasn't in a prison at this time, wrote a letter to Lenin and told him that this kind of communism with the rule of the Central Committee will collapse after some time. This is not the way we can do it. And she was right. She promised the end in the beginning. This is one thing. The other is, it is a long period of policy started by Willy Brandt and others, and Kreisky and Palmer, to speak with the other side. It's a process leading to Helsinki, to the conference of Helsinki, when the Soviet Union was forced to accept the human rights. And this was the beginning and the basis for Solidarność, for groups in Hungary and later on also in East Germany, to build up a kind of opposition, inside opposition, mostly in Germany with a Protestant church, and in Poland with a Catholic church. It became more and more powerful. And the Soviet Union was only reacting to these things up to this point of the collapse of the whole system. I don't think it's possible to say that, like Mr. Bush did, I have done it. That's not. I think also the communists in Czechoslovakia during the Prague Spring, also if they failed because the armored cars were coming from five neighbor countries, occupied Czechoslovakia, the idea to reform communism was a last chance for them to do it, and they didn't. This was the beginning of the end. The spring in Prague, with Dubček, and Dubček was up to his end. He was a socialist.
But it's more than a failed economic system as well.
Yeah.
People don't want to live at the point of a gun. And, of course, having a democracy brings many, many responsibilities and lots of incumbent problems. But, essentially, people want the freedom of movement. In the Soviet Union, you couldn't, under communism, travel across the country, check into a hotel in the city in which you lived. You couldn't really write, create. This is not a normal way of living. So, in addition to the economic problems, just the fact that people hungered for freedom. And I think, and I'm sure as a European you can attest to this, the European countries held under communism really looked to the West and were envious of the West for the things that people could do there that they could not do where they lived.
But you will find this also in the Western world, that people are not able to use the freedom they have because the economic situation for them is like in South Africa or in large parts of India, whose democracy is not possible for them to use this kind of freedom we have on paper. What I think, and this is the most difficult thing we need, is a democracy with all freedom we need, but also a kind of a social system who does bring to capitalism this human touch we need. This mixture we tried in Western Europe. If you look to the Scandinavian states, also to France, to Italy, to Germany, we teach capitalism to be civilized.
Would you adopt the socialist of the Scandinavian countries as a model?
Yes, this was and is still one model, to have on one side all the civil rights, the democratic rights, for everybody, but also the security of a social system for the old people, for the unemployed people, for the upper class, mm-hmm. Not only for the upper class, also for the majority of people who are not able to use by themselves all this marvelous promises of democracy.
Yeah, I think that capitalism is an ideal, but in a complex society such as we have in the West.
You think really that capitalism is an ideal? I think capitalism is a method to organize a free market.
Is a what?
To organize a free market without limits. A free exchange of things we need. But if capitalism is organizing themselves also like an ideology, it's going the same way than communism is doing. Then they believe their own lies. You cannot establish a market from the Western point of view in countries who are underdeveloped. A market from the Western point of view cannot really work.
Yeah, but even in a wealthy nation such as the United States, with its complexity sure. and the enormous poverty, you just can't allow
sure.
people to exist in that way.
Yeah.
Which is why we don't have a pure capitalist society in the United States, probably more than most of the European nations. But it is a mixture of socialism and capitalism here.
I don't see the socialism, because this was there was once President Roosevelt tried this, and as far as I know, looking back, President Johnson was one of your presidents who tried inside to give a social system to the capitalistic system, to mix it up. But in the 80s, all this was destroyed. This is one of the reasons that you have the problems of an undeveloped country in a very rich country inside.
That's
you
right.
It's a third world inside your own state.
Yeah, the Reagan administration set out to dismantle the government and succeeded mm-hmm. disastrously, mm-hmm. which is why these people were voted out of office.
Yes. And this period, the 80s, Reagan administration and Bush administration afterwards, this influenced also Europe, as you know. And I think we will have to pay for this lost 80s. In this 10 years or more than 10 years, we didn't do the job that was necessary. Perhaps the ecologic questions didn't get answers. Now we are confronted to the results of this mistakes.
Now you said something very interesting. You said in India, mm-hmm. No matter how great the freedom is, mm-hmm. what good is it? Mm-hmm. In effect, you said this. What mm-hmm. good is it if people are so poor mm-hmm. that they can't apply this freedom to themselves? Now, I was reading Show Your Tongues, a beautiful, beautiful book, which is about your sojourn in Calcutta.
Yeah.
And you could see firsthand that a pure economic system and pure freedom wasn't functioning well.
No.
Can you tell me a little bit about this odyssey that you had in India?
You see, we are also speaking with our Western knowledge, with our experience perhaps we had in Europe. We had this the French Revolution. There was this long period of enlightenment in literature and against the rulership of the church and the Middle Age. It was the end of the Middle Age. But this didn't happen in other parts of the world. And if we carry our very logical Western ideas to these countries, we will find a society who is not prepared to ideas like this. They have, perhaps in Africa, I've seen they have other understanding of societies. But these societies mostly are destroyed by the colonial system of the Western world before. The frontiers are cutting off tribes and so on. And we are now we have still the problems as a result of the colonial times, also in India. The participation between Muslims and Hindus. That was British policy during the colonial time to work with this dualism. And now, in our days, the gap between the rich nations and the poor, the third world, is growing. It's growing the same time the population is growing. And the ecologic problems are growing. And the situation after the breakdown of the Soviet Union, we see now that the Western world is on one side the winner of this Cold War, but on the other side has no idea how to handle the new problems we have, like in Yugoslavia.
Just on a personal note, what was it like for you personally as you lived for that year or so in India?
It was the second time I was in Calcutta. The first was only a short visit, and I thought always I have to come back to stay there a longer time and really to be confronted with these problems. And after a short time I saw that I'm a stranger, I'm coming from another culture background, and I lost all my words in the beginning. I couldn't write about it. And I started to make drawings, come nearer to this kind of reality. And with the help of my drawings, it was possible to start again to write about it. The diary and afterwards the last part of the book is a long poem about Calcutta. But all this, also the diary and the poem and the drawings, are trying also to show the difference, the understanding and the not understanding, and also the not understanding inside the understanding. Perhaps we have learned with our European Christian moral system to live between despair on one side and hope on the other side. People who are living for generations in slums, they don't know about hope or despair. They live from day to day. It is an essential question for them. They are much more trained to survive than we are.
You mentioned your drawings. All of the dust jacket designs for your books. These are all yours, aren't they?
All mine.
How did it happen that you have been able to combine your art with your writing in this way?
I have these two gifts, and there was no reason to take one away. And I'm very happy that I can do both, and in times when I have finished a book, it's mostly for a writer a very difficult period, then he is jumping in a hole. He has nothing more to do. Then I start with my drawings. But it's a great help on one side. On the other side, I don't make the mistake to start a new book too early. And also, this is the practical side. The other is from my beginning, the first things are poems. And the most manuscripts I have written are mixed up with drawings. The image is in the beginning. First a sketch by a drawing, then the first lines written down. The things are working together. And from this, it was possible for me, not only the first volumes I have published were poetry with drawings together, and all dust jackets of my books are done by myself. And in India, it was quite necessary for me, as I told you, first to go to the slums, not able to write about it, but to make sketches, to come nearer to this kind of reality. And it was very interesting that the people in the slums accepted that I made drawings there. It would be very possible to make a photo, since they don't like at all. But somebody who is sitting down there making a sketch, they like it more than any other thing. And by making this drawing, it was possible for me, as I told you, afterwards to write again.
Do you exhibit your artwork separately? Do you have exhibits?
Yes, I have exhibits, and I make many. Some of the dust jackets, perhaps also here of the Call of the Toad and the Red, are etchings. Mm-hmm. I make many etchings and make.
Well, this is.
That's always ink. That's
ink. A brush and pen.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Now let's go back a little bit. The Tin Drum was your first novel. It's an unforgettable book, and an unforgettable film. By the way, I had seen the movie version of it. I thought I had it, and I was looking all over for it this week. I have about 2,000 videos at home, and for some reason I couldn't find it. But this was your first book, and perhaps just on a historical level, you can tell me how this book came about.
After the war, I was trained as a stonemason and then as a sculptor in art school in Düsseldorf and later on in Berlin. And I was writing also in this time, but mostly poetry and playwrights, short playwrights, one-act playwrights. But I had always this idea in my head, this kind of epic novel. But I didn't see how it would be possible for me to do this. It was, and then with the change from Berlin to Paris, I started this book. And I thought first this will be my only novel I write, and then I go back to poetry and other things. But when I had finished the Tin Drum, I just began afterwards to write Cat and Mouse, and it was going on like this. And it's up to now, no end. It is one of the reasons I think all these books, also the last one, are situated in Danzig and later on in Gdansk. And there's always the relation between the German Danzig and the later Polish Gdansk. I'm writing about something what I have lost.
And you were born in Danzig.
I'm born in Danzig. Yeah. I lost my hometown, like millions of Germans who are born in East Germany, in this part in Schlesia, East Prussia, or in Danzig, or Pomerania. They're lost. It's now Polish. And for me it was the only possibility to make a literary reconstruction of this, what I have lost. And to give answers to myself why we have lost it. Also to give answers to other people. And the first books are only concentrated to the lost city of Danzig, who was destroyed 80% at the end of the war. But later on, from visit to visit to Gdansk, I became more and more involved in the story of Gdansk of our days. In the Flounder, perhaps the last chapter is concentrated to the workers of the Lenin Werft, shipyards of the Lenin shipyard in Gdansk, and the first strike in 1970, that's the born of the Solidarność. And this was the beginning of my involvement also with not only with the German story of the city, also now with the Polish story of the city. And in the last book, the two strings are coming together.
You were a soldier in World War II.
What do you mean?
You were a soldier in World War II.
Yes, I became a soldier when I was 16, the last year of the war. Yeah.
You were 16?
16, yes, and at the end of the war I was 17.
And
when 16? And when I left the prison camp I was 18. This was part of my youth time. Yes.
Was it a Soviet prison camp?
No, this was an American prison camp. I was wounded near Berlin, happily. In the last weeks of the war and came to an hospital more to the west, and this was captured by the Third American Army, General Patton.
I would assume that experience shaped you, especially happening as young as it did.
Yes, when I look back, I think when I was 17, 18 years old, And this, yes, 45, 46, I was really cynical. I was an old man. I was young. I was in and with all these problems of a young man in this age. But on the other side, I had seen dead people. I had seen burned down cities. All my ideas were corrupted. At the end, I saw what has happened with my generation in Germany, coming from the Hitler Youth and to the army. And then I didn't believe first when I saw the first photos of Auschwitz and Treblinka. My first idea was, and also of my comrades, this are propaganda lies. This is not possible. The Germans have done this. And then I heard also in a prison camp by radio the Nuremberg Tribunal against the Nazi figures. And then my former youth leader, Baldo von Schirach, he said that that's true. We have done this. And he tried to protect the Hitler Youth, that they are not guilty, but he felt himself like guilty. And then I believed. It was still just after the war, it was necessary for me to hear from these people, our leaders, what terrible things we have done in Germany. And this story is, if I want or not, but this is in all my books up to the end, there's no end to see.
Wow, your experience, what a way to mature. Being wounded, being in a prisoner of war camp at an age when most young men are thinking about girls and
yes,
cars.
I too did think about girls, but there was no time.
You live in Berlin now?
In Berlin and in West Germany on the country, the two places, yes.
Were you there at the time the wall was dismantled?
Yes.
Tell me what that was like.
It was like a present given to us in Germany by people from Poland, by the Solidarność movement, before by the Czechoslovakian communists who did make the Prague Spring, and at last Mr. Gorbachev, who did give us this possibility to come together. There was a small group also in East Germany who did really resist against the system. But only a small group. And I was wondering what we will do now. Then I saw after a short time that the government in West Germany and also the opposition, my own party, the Social Democrats, without any idea what to do now. They only saw the reunification. They didn't see the difficulties to bring people together who did live more than 40 years in different systems. And from October, November 1989, I wrote about these problems. Many articles and speeches and warning not to hurry up, to do it slowly, without any results. I hurried up, and now we have a terrible result. We have the wall is away. No wall anymore, but the country is again divided, socially divided.
But what was it like, not just in political terms, but what was it like as that wall began to become dismantled? For example...
It was a short dream, really a short dream, some hours of surprise and happiness. People are coming together who didn't see each other for years and years. But then the economic situation overwhelmed everything. And you will not find in Germany anymore this atmosphere of hope and the enthusiasm of the first hours. And for me it was, I had this idea of Call of a Toad long before in my head, but it was like an abstract, archaic idea without a place, without a time, and I couldn't write it. And when these things happened from the autumn of 89, immediately I saw this can only happen in these days, in these days of change, change from day to day. And it was clear it only can happen in Gdansk. And how I did it, the story started in November, the beginning of November, some days before the wall collapsed in Berlin. And it's going to June of 91. And it is for a writer always a risk to write parallel to the time, to the running time. We mostly like some distance. But I liked also this risk some things also to be quicker than time is.
Now, you write in German, and your books have been translated into languages all over the world. Tell me something about the translation process. Your English is pretty good. Do you read English well?
More or less, yes.
Do you read the English versions of your books?
No, I do other things. When I finish a book like this, it was not just printed, and only the first proofs were printed. There was an invitation to all my translators, and we came together in my house in West Germany. It was 9 translators. I did this first with the Flounder, then I did with the meeting in Telgte, the Red, and now with the Call of the Toad. The translators asked me terrible questions. Side by side, the whole book, and I have to answer, and what's not clear, and this is the best help I can give to the translators. That's not only a dialogue between me and the, in this case, 9 translators, it's also a dialogue between the translators, the Spanish translator and the Italian translator in the Roman languages, or between the Norwegian and the Danish translator, or the Czechoslovakian and the Polish translator, if they have some difficulties, how you will do this, and I will try like this, and I really love these meetings with the translators.
Yeah, it would seem to me that translating a book is more than just translating the words; it's also translating the spirit.
Yeah, and I encourage always the translators to invent things. Not only to follow line by line. If there are so many things in German language, you cannot translate directly. You have to take the spirit of the book. You have to carry in your language that the reader, the English reader, or the Polish reader, or the Spanish reader, doesn't have the feeling I'm reading a translation. He must have the feeling I'm reading a Spanish, a Polish, or an English book.
Well, we're out of time now, Günter Grass. The Call of the Toad is a wonderful book, and with delightful pictures, and you certainly are a literary a treasure, and I thank you very, very much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.